Rick Ganley, NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. .26%. That, education officials say, was New Hampshire's dropout rate toward the end of 2012. It's one of the lowest rates in the nation, and a far cry from the rates in 2007, when then-Governor John Lynch signed a law raising the dropout age from 16 to 18 and giving districts 2 years to strengthen support systems for at-risk students, including alternatives such as evening classes and team teaching techniques to set them on a path toward graduating with their peers. Some districts in New Hampshire have made huge strides, even achieving zero dropout rates. But there are still challenges. For one thing, the rate of 1.26% is slightly higher than the rate in 2011. And in some districts, the dropout rate has stayed stubbornly high, including in the state's largest district, Manchester. Meanwhile, state officials have warned that school districts will likely have to deal with more lean school budgets, which means fewer dollars for the programs that have proven keys to progress. Today on The Exchange, we check in with New Hampshire's dropout rate. What's working, what isn't, and where we go from here. And let's hear from you. What's happening in your school district to keep students in school? Do you know of students who have benefited from dropout prevention programs? What about the issue of cutbacks to school budgets? What's the best way schools can use their limited resources to address these problems? Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or send a question or comment through The Exchange's page on Facebook. Our guest for the hour, Paul Leather. He's Deputy Commissioner of the New Hampshire Department of Education. Paul Leather, great to have you back with us. Mark Joyce is with us. He's the Executive Director of the New Hampshire School Administrators Association, and it's welcome back to you as well.
Good morning, Brady.
And Rob Fried joins us, Executive Director of the Upper Valley Educators Institute and the author of several books, including The Game of School. And welcome back to you, Rob.
Thank you.
Paul Leather, could you take us back to the time before Governor Lynch made this push to reduce dropouts? Where was the state's dropout rate before 2007?
Well, depending on the way statistics were gathered, we were somewhere between 9% and 15% in terms of a cohort rate over 4 years, and we were staying very consistent at that number. And I think when Governor Lynch raised the compulsory age of education through legislative process and engaged educators in the belief that all students can and should graduate from high school, and engage students and parents in that process and communities in that process, we saw a real change, so that in the last couple of years, it's been down to 2 years ago, a little less than 1%, and now we're about 1.26%.
And now when we say that the dropout rate is 1.26%, does that necessarily mean then that the graduation rate in New Hampshire is 98 and a fraction percentage there? You can see how well I did in math when I was in school.
Right. But not exactly. There are some folks who complete but do not actually get graduation. But our graduation rate has also increased considerably and steadily over that same period of time. We're about 86, 87% graduation rate.
Mark Joyce, you followed education in this state for many years. What were you hearing in the mid-2000s about this idea of raising the age at which students could drop out of school, which was then 16, now it's 18? Were there arguments against raising the age?
Well, I think there have been arguments on all sides that they kind of looked at the challenges of our society. When we look at those years that I've been in the business, we see that the percent of students who entered kindergarten and actually completed high school roughly mirror the decade markers of the 20th century. So in the 1960s, when I was in high school, only about 60% of children completed. Many were excluded. Some were drafted. Some left school to go to work. But as we progressed as a society and approached 2000 and No Child Left Behind, and as Paul mentioned, in New Hampshire, moving the dropout age up to 18, the expectation was 100% of children would complete. And so I think it's been a gradual 40-year transition But I think it's the awareness by society as a whole that students desperately need, at least, to complete high school.
And the argument is they need that because of their job prospects going forward and more.
I think more. I think it's also being a good citizen, being a productive member of their community, and having opportunities for their own future.
Now, what do you hear today from officials and educators about that argument, trying to make 100% the goal? And has that changed since, say, 10 years ago?
Oh, I think it has. I think with the aid of the state's policy, but the hard work of educators and local communities, schools have moved towards personalizing learning for all children, trying to create an individual pathway. Where we've had remarkable success, like up in the North Conway area or in the city of Dover, the Governor Wentworth District, they are community-wide engagement with a whole variety of alternatives. Where we've had challenges are the places where our students in greatest need are concentrated. And I would say those children are kids who might be very poor, might speak another language, might be engaged in drug abuse, or might be homeless. And many of those are concentrated in our largest urban areas.
Paul Leather, it sounds like some of those common trends, I guess we could say, about students who are at risk of dropping out could be found in any part of the state. And are those the ones that you're seeing at the Department of Education?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Issues of attendance, issues of behavior, issues of student performance in school. We see all of those all across the state. But I really want to underline what Mark raised before, that in New Hampshire, where we see the biggest concern are in those places, typically cities, where students are either new to the country or have our low socioeconomic background or come from families that have split up and are transitional in nature. In those situations, we tend to see much more resistance to students continuing and completing. And we actually did a research project with Robert Balfonce of Johns Hopkins University, the foremost national expert on dropouts. And he predicted that this is the area where we would really have to focus the greatest. So working with communities like Manchester and Laconia, Claremont, Rochester, and others, that where these families and students tend to congregate and live and often just really are challenged in terms of completing school.
Rob Fried, we've talked about some of these external factors that can make it difficult for a student who's in school, be that poverty, be that homelessness, be that learning a new language. What about some of the internal factors? Are there issues within a school or, for a student who is within a school that could also lead them towards seeing, well, maybe this isn't for me, maybe I'll just drop out and see what happens?
Yes, I do think we need to celebrate the successes. It's so often that educators get criticized for looking at the failings, but this has really been a concerted effort and to reduce the physical dropout problem. I think there are other kinds of dropping out that we need to look at as well, particularly as the numbers of students who physically leave or don't complete reaches a minimal point. There are students who drop out cognitively. They stop caring about what's going on.
They're physically still in the class.
There are students who drop out in terms of their affect, their attitude. They sit down there and develop a very cynical attitude towards school and just don't think it means anything to them. And then there are kids who drop out intellectually in that they are so focused only on the grade, only on getting the right answer, that they're not interested in thinking critically. And I think that if we look at what it means to drop out, it would really benefit us to look at all of the dimensions of dropping out, not just those who physically fail to complete their four-year education.
In a way, there might be a parallel in the unemployment rate where we talk about the people who are measured as unemployed, but then there's also this other number of people who, say, have stopped looking for work. And so when you factor them in, then there's perhaps a higher number.
Right. And in terms of the employment picture, it's not just completing 4 years of school that's important. It's completing high school with an attitude and a zest for learning that's going to make the difference whether you go to college or get into a career right away. Those students who sort of don't finish college and those students who stay at the minimal level job because they haven't really been prepared emotionally, intellectually, socially, to really engage in learning, which is now the lifelong pursuit.
Mark Joyce, there's clearly been a number of students who in the years since 2007, have been able to stay in school that might not have before. Is there something different about their circumstances that has been addressed in that time since the law changed, or is it simply that they were in school districts that happened to have programs that addressed the needs and that their circumstances might have been the same as a student who still might drop out today?
I think one of the fundamental changes that has occurred, again, supported by state policy and in the case of one example, by state funding, are offering opportunities to personalize learning in very real ways. For example, the state of New Hampshire has led the way by funding a statewide virtual school. Now, while online learning is not for all children, for some children, it's a remarkable match. And I would speak there of the Virtual Learning Academy, or VLACS, New Hampshire, where students can attend based on their interest. And so there are now full-time students who would testify that they were not engaged in school in the traditional way, but now they are. We have other practices in place in our schools where kids are allowed to go to night school so they can pursue a career during the day. I think of the community of Salem. I think of Dover. I think of other places, the Timberlane District, which has had an evening program.
And we'll talk to one of the leaders of that district actually after a short break and find out what it is that has worked in their school district. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. More after a short break. This is NHPR.
It's The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Mike Danielli.
Yeah, not bad.
NHPR's news team is your ears around the state, but we're also your eyes. Take a look at the pictures from the week's news on our Granite Scene photo blog. Each Friday, we post the most interesting pictures from the week taken by our producers and reporters. The Granite Scene photo blog is at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from Newburyport 5-Cent Savings Bank, opening in May in downtown Portsmouth with full-service commercial banking, introducing mobile deposit online at newburyportbank.com. And from Keene State College Summer Session, accelerating time to degree with a full range of courses in the arts, sciences, and professional programs. Registration open for summer now at keene.edu. And from A&B Lumber and Home Centers, featuring windows and doors by Marvin and Integrity for modeling and replacement projects in Pembroke, Moultonboro, and at ablumber.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Today on The Exchange, disparities in New Hampshire's high school dropout rates, what's worked, what hasn't, and where we go from here. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. Send a short email to exchange at nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. For the hour, we're joined by three guests: Paul Leather, Deputy Commissioner of the New Hampshire Department of Education; Mark Joyce, Executive Director of the New Hampshire School Administrators Association; and Rob Fried, Executive Director of the Upper Valley Educators Institute and the author of several books, including The Game of School. Again, we'd like to hear from you at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Just before the break, Mark Joyce, you were talking about some of the programs that had impressed you, whether it be a statewide online learning source or night classes. And I wanted to ask you, Paul Leather, what are some of the programs that have been developed over the recent years that have really seemed to work well, and what is it about them that works so well?
Well, I think any program that really addresses the academic needs of students, really engages them, addresses the needs that they might have personally, and really engages them around what their career expectations might be over time and their expectations beyond high school. When we see all of those elements, we see really some tremendous movement. So a number of the charter schools in the state have really addressed that. But we've also seen a number of programs, like Mark mentioned, with the Virtual Learning Academy, and a number of our high schools really put together comprehensive efforts to address dropouts. Our career and technical centers have reached out to students who have been alternative learners, and that has been also significant. Another movement that's really been, I think, significant has been the movement to competency education. Let me just mention one specific example, the Virtual Learning Academy. They offer their courses not just as full courses, but also in terms of specific competencies that students need to gain. So if a student doesn't pass a course in their regular class, they can go and get the competency that they did not get in terms of passing that course through VLACs, and then get a passing grade in the course. And that's just an example where New Hampshire educators are working together to really do the best for all of our students.
Rob.
Yes, I think in the past 20 or 30 years, the biggest changes, positive changes that I've seen are what Paul talked about in terms of moving from delivering instruction to measuring competency. What does the student really know? And what Mark mentioned, which is the focus on helping individual students. This is a huge change. 20, 30 years ago, it was, well, here's our program. If the kids want to take it, they can take it. If they don't, it's up to them. And now the whole idea that what students think and how they feel matters. And I think that's been great. I think we need to move now to look at some of the other endemic problems and issues that affect how students feel about school.
Do we get to a point then where, to sort of extend it out beyond students who are at risk of dropping out, do we get to a point where we might say, well, personalized learning could be for every kid? You know, I mean, we talk about the Follow the Child initiative in mm-hmm. this state. Do we get to that point where there are a range of options rather than a one model until we see something else working for a student?
We need to see that range not only in schools, but in every classroom. We need to see teachers saying, here, there are several ways to go about achieving this skill, this showing us this mastery. And it really begins to focus on the school as a learning organization rather than just a teaching organization.
Mark, did you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I would totally agree with both of those observations. I'd cite as an excellent example of school culture change the use of the PBIS program, the Positive Behavioral Intervention, where it creates a culture in a school that's accepting of all students, which paves the way for the individual learning pathways. However, I think a word to the other side of the issue is important. While this is our goal, not all of New Hampshire school districts have sufficient resources to be able to accomplish that. And so if we were to look at some of our largest cities where they have an extraordinary number of classes with well over 30 students, you can see the challenge that the educators have at trying to personalize. And so we need to work further on that issue as well.
Let's hear from one of our listeners. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And Catherine is calling from South Sutton. Hi, Catherine. You're on the exchange.
Hi. I work with the arts and work with arts education both in and out of schools. And I just wanted to support everything everyone's saying, but add that a really strong quality arts education program, both maintaining quality arts educators in the school and the shared delivery model of partnering with community arts to really help increase graduation rates and bring that zest and motivate students, engage them. Many students find their passion around music and the arts. There's a lot of good research on the National Arts Education Partnership website.
And anecdotally, too, Catherine, I was talking recently with a New Hampshire teacher who was nominated for a national award. She was a music teacher, but she used music to teach other parts of the curriculum as well. So they would, say, do a musical with a historical setting. They would look at the social studies part of that as well, or they would delve into the literature topic. So, Paul Leather, you can use that not simply as to reach students who are interested in arts or music, but as a way to go into other parts of the curriculum as well.
Well, absolutely. There is actually some very good research that students who do well in music also do well in math. And so we encourage a broad and deep curriculum. We certainly understand that people are concerned about state testing around English language arts and math and want to see performance there. But I think if you have a deep curriculum, including the arts, you're going to accomplish that over time. And if I could just add that I think another reason why Catherine's comment is so important is that there are a million reasons why kids drop out. But we start to look at it in terms of a continuum from hopelessness to hope. If a student has hope that their education is going to bring them to another place, bring them to where they want to go, and that their parents will be proud of them, they'll be a strong member of their community, whether it's in the arts or any other area, then they will stay with it. They will stay with their education. And so these ways of engaging students in learning, whether it's through the arts, whether it's through an engagement on a particular project that they're working on, that makes all the difference. That is when the student is really hooked into learning.
It comes back to what you were talking about earlier, Rob, that idea of a student not cognitively checking out but staying engaged in what they're studying every day in class.
When Paul talks about hope, he reminds me that of the research that's done that high aspirations lead to high achievement. And if students are feeling that little is expected of them, that just going through the motions and getting in some panning in something in time will be accepted, then that leads to an internal or mental or cognitive dropping out that's really really a disaster.
Catherine, thank you so much for your call. The exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. We mentioned earlier that some of the highest dropout rates in New Hampshire are in schools in Manchester. And joining us now by phone is Tom Brennan, superintendent for the school district in Manchester. He joins us by phone. Tom Brennan, always good to talk with you.
Same here. Welcome.
What do the rates in your district look like today for students dropping out, and how do they compare with the dropout rate in past years?
Well, I think there was a period of time where we were fortunate enough to have the resources, mainly through the great support we're receiving from the Department of Education and ARRA funding, that we were able to help contribute to that low number that we achieved a couple of years ago. But historically, we've been challenged with the amount of students who, and I know I've been listening, so that notion of hopelessness I referred to as the habit of hopelessness, that we continue to have students and folks believe that that's a habit that they're going to continue. So as everyone knows, I'm sure, particularly those who are listening to your program, our rates jumped this past year. We can contribute that to many factors, but they're unacceptable, those rates. In spite of our efforts, we continue to offer some of the programs and opportunities. I have a difficulty using the word alternative. It sounds like they did something wrong, so they have to do something alternatively in learning. It's really about opportunities. Our school district provides policies and that allow for students to take extended learning opportunities, dual credit, using credit outside of the classroom, and all those types of things, which are very beneficial. at times I reflect, I wonder what our dropout rate would be if we didn't have these opportunities presented to our students. So it's unacceptable. We will continue to move forward in trying to develop options and opportunities for our students, and as others have indicated, to break that habit of hopelessness.
You mentioned ARRA, and for those who don't know, that's the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, so the part of the federal stimulus program, there were education funds. Could you describe a little bit about what you aren't now able to offer without those funds and other sources of funding like them?
Sure, and I don't want everyone to say it's all about money, but in this particular case, during those opportunities that we had, we were able to hire outreach folks who would identify students who were not in school, actively engaged in school, and then we would send these individuals out and work with them, develop, as Mark indicated, and others, individual plans of recovery and to get back on track. And so that's one example, and we continue, as many people know, to have a very tight budget. And as a result, that's one example that we aren't able to do. The class loads continue to be high because of staffing and also because of the staffing restrictions and limits. So those are part of the reasons why, but those shouldn't prevent us from continuing to try to move forward.
Now, earlier in the hour, Mark Joyce was talking about some of the other challenges that students who are at risk of dropping out are facing, and many of them were external factors. So they weren't simply that their school was not providing the right kinds of programs, is that they may not have even been coming to school ready to learn, and I wonder how much of that you see.
Oh, I see that as a significant issue. If we could redirect our resources, I would be an advocate of starting schooling as early as the age of four. Ensuring that students by their ninth or tenth age, that they are at reading level. A majority of students that I encounter for behavioral or attitudinal issues have poor reading skills and writing skills, and they're embarrassed about their inability to keep up with their peers, and so they act out. So the sooner we get into it, the better. I believe, and I'm not unique in this thought, but we need to put more consideration on the starting line as opposed to the finishing line, which is important. But it's my contention and others that if we're able to do something earlier, stronger, and more consistent, that we will start to see a diminishing of the other end in terms of dropout rates or lack of graduation rates.
Well, Tom Brennan, thanks so much for talking with us today. We appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you again.
That's Tom Brennan, Superintendent of Schools in Manchester. Today on The Exchange, checking in on New Hampshire's dropout rate. You can join the conversation with your call to 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Mark Joyce, we were listening to Tom Brennan talking, and he talked not only about the difficulty of helping students who were at risk of dropping out, say, in high school, but also seeing some of those disturbing trends much earlier on. And I'm curious, what do schools and what does the state try to do when they see a kid who might be at risk, say, in kindergarten or in grade school or middle school, so that they don't wind up being at risk when they're 16 or 17?
Well, that's a great question, and I think the research is strong to call the investment in early childhood to be one of the best investments we have. New Hampshire has not been a leader in this area historically. It wasn't until recently that we had our mandatory kindergarten opportunity, but that has been a step forward. We see more districts finding the resource to reach younger by having preschool integrated programs in their school buildings. Some cases moving to full-day kindergarten for those students who might be at risk early on, or at least provide that alternative to families. But I think, no doubt, that's our next frontier. As Tom so articulately said, we should concentrate more on the starting line than simply the finish line.
Paul Leather, you wanted to weigh in on that, too?
Yes, I think both Mark and Tom made good points. And one of the things that we've learned through the research is that dropping out is not so much an event but a process. And so there are some very clear markers that occur as students move through the educational system. And so we've developed actually early warning indicators and are working with our schools both at the elementary, middle, and the high school level so that we're looking at attendance and absenteeism, behavioral indicators, as well as performance in school. Those students that are not reading at third grade, those students that are not on grade level in middle school, those students that are not able to perform high school basic functions in terms of English and mathematics, really they're struggling just to stay in the environment.
Rob Fried, we talked about that continuum of hopefulness and hopelessness, mm-hmm. and it feels like a kid who's having trouble in grade school, that's just going to cascade as they move from grade to grade, that they're going to feel further behind and that they're going to feel that teachers and other students know that they're further behind.
Yes, and that gets exacerbated when they are placed in ability groups or tracks with only kids that have been similarly adjudicated. And that happens more in high school. So the kids in the middle elementary school that at least are surrounded by other kids that have higher aspirations, if they end up in a high school that tracks them at a low level, they look around and say, we might as well give up.
Can you split that difference then so that so that teachers are able to work with students where they are, but also then not sort of overly label them so that they don't feel any motivation to try and move up and try to learn more?
Well, I think it has to do with the culture of the school and the culture of the classroom. If we find a culture where teachers are excited about what they're doing, where the engagement level is high, that has a spill-out effect on all kids. The research, unfortunately, goes the other way, that the longer kids stay in school, the less engaged they are. The longer kids stay in school, the less creative they tend to be. Those are research data from the Gallup organization and other places. So I think the issue of having them stay engaged is more serious at the high school level than at the elementary and middle school.
Your thoughts, Mark Joyce?
I think the whole notion of engagement is, I think, critical to the solution. And one part we haven't emphasized enough is the need to engage the entire community. And by that, I mean not simply giving sufficient resources towards education, but kind of a community-wide commitment to improve and to deliver over time. You heard that from Tom and his message. We also see it from successful places, and one I would hold out is the work in the Mount Washington Valley around Kennett High School and the complete commitment of the entire valley to improve, and that include business leaders, civic leaders, parents, and students.
And we'll come right back to that point after a short break. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
It's 9:39, and you're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from the Diabetes and Endocrinology Center at Frisbee Memorial Hospital in Rochester, providing comprehensive diabetes care to patients across southeastern New Hampshire, frisbeehospital.com. And from Rath Young and Pignatelli, with law offices in Concord, Nashua, and Boston, National Impact, uniquely New Hampshire, on the web at rathlaw.com. This is NHPR.
Today on Word of Mouth, had it up to here with the two-party system? We'll hear the Centrist Manifesto. A Dartmouth professor advocates for ditching ideological gridlock with a third-party platform built on compromise. We'll talk over the practicalities of a real-world centrist party outside of the ivory tower. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth explores the middle ground today at noon and again at 9 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we look at reverse innovation. Email us at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning at 9 for more of The Exchange. Today on the program, checking in on the dropout rate. While the statewide rate looks good at a glance, a closer look reveals some higher numbers in certain parts of New Hampshire. We're looking at why that is and what's being done to mitigate it. And we'd love you to join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. We've been talking about what works and what doesn't in lowering the number of students who drop out. Let's turn to a district that has made some significant strides on that front, Timberlane Regional School District, which serves students in Atkinson, Danville, Sandown, and Plastow. Joining us now by phone is Scott Strange, Director of Secondary Education for the district. And Scott, it's great to have you with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, how did this all come about? Where was Timberland, say, in 2007 when this law changed, and what has changed since then?
Well, 2007, we had already started to make some strides towards helping our students stay in school. If you go all the way back to 2000, our number was at about 5%. We saw some steady drops over the years into 2007, and then starting in 2007 with the change in the law, some of the additions that we made to our programs, our rate as of today is at 0.28. So we've gone down from 2.2 in 2007 to 0.28 today. So we've been successful in helping those students to finish their high school years here with us.
So what does a student in this district have as an option or options when the traditional high school model doesn't seem to be working? What could they do then instead?
Sure. Starting in 2007, we started an evening division program that's actually really an extension of our day program. That evening division program is directly connected to all of the curriculum of the day division. So a student taking English 1 or American Lit or Social Studies course in the evening is following the same curriculum as our day division. So you can earn day credits or regular credits throughout the course of our evening division program as well. It's not a separate remedial program, so it's an extension of our day. We also started in 2008 something called the GED Option Program, which is you can earn a high school diploma as well as a GED in this simultaneous program. It's run with a special ed director and a regular ed director that take care of this program throughout the course of the year. We generally have anywhere between 8 and 10 students participating in that particular program. And then in our evening division program, we have anywhere between 40 and upwards of 70 sometimes students taking part in the courses that are happening during the evening division. So a student that may be struggling during the day, a student that may be struggling at home and having to work for their family to help support their family or take care of small children or whatever it happens to be, students that may find themselves in some difficulty getting to school during the day, this evening division option runs from 4 o'clock. It starts at 4, and the last class ends at 9 o'clock at night. So students have an opportunity to continue their program, continue towards a graduation in the evening division as well as in the day. And we don't have just kids that take evening division courses. We have some day division students that take evening division to augment their day division program and allow them to maybe take an engineering course or a band course or some other course that may not fit into their schedule.
Now, how much of this is tailored toward the individual needs of the communities in your district? Is this something that any school district in New Hampshire could simply pick up as a playbook and translate into their school district, or no?
I'm sure that it could. There's nothing really particular, like I said, that we're doing. We took our curriculum, and we teach it at night. I think the commitment is the financial commitment to say yes, we are going to allow this, to be a part of our regular program. Because we try to call it evening division, not night school, because night school has these certain things that are attached to it, certain stigmas or understandings that may be attached to it. And this is a different model. It's not a remedial program. It's not a dumping ground. It's not a place where, okay, let's take our most difficult students and just put them in there out of the population. We have our regular teachers are teaching there. Like I said, we have students that may have some difficulty getting a particular course in during the day. We have an engineering program or our very popular and very successful band program where students may have difficulty fitting those into their schedule. They can take courses at night. We're also partnering now with Southern New Hampshire University to basically turn our campus into a satellite for them. We have some dual enrollment program already with them where we have 4 courses during the day that are dual enrollments with Southern New Hampshire University. We want to extend that into the evening division. We want to extend it out to our community so that adults can take Southern New Hampshire University courses, college courses on our campus. So we're really starting to sort of grow that circle out and widen it.
Last question for you. And you mentioned the concerns about costs. And how is that potentially going to affect these kinds of programs in the next few years? Because as we know, it's not easy to simply say, well, we can put a whole bunch of more money into more programs these days. That's not usually how the conversations play out, do they?
It certainly is. You're correct with that. But part of it is, you know, we've shown such amazing success with the program, you know, that it's one of the things that we've been very, very careful of here in Timberlane over the last decade is that in terms of looking at our budget, the first thing that we want to do is we want to support our programs. We've been very cautious about making any budget cuts that would impact programmatically. You know, we take a look at our staffing, and if we have retirements or we have people that may be leaving for, you know, whatever reason, their family is moving to Chicago or something, we try to say, okay, can we absorb that loss rather than, you know, taking something out of a programmatic piece? And it's been such a successful piece, and we're looking to grow it, as I said, into becoming a real part of the community. I think that that really helps us to make the case to the community that this is the way to support all of our students. And that's really what we're looking at. You know, that's been our mantra. How do we support all of our students, our valedictorian all the way down to the person that is graduating in the lower end of the class? How do we support all of those students? And this really is a crucial element to help in a number of different ways, as we've seen over these last years.
Well, Scott Strange, we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Scott Strange is Director of Secondary Education for the Timberlane Regional School District. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, and we have a number of callers on the line right now looking to weigh in. Shelley is joining us now from Peterborough. Hi, Shelley. You're on the exchange.
Yes, hi. Well, I have a story that's a little different. My son is now 27 years old, but when he was 17 and in his junior year, he came home one day and said, I want to quit school. And we said, oh, you do. And after thinking about it and seeing the challenges he was having, seeing that his learning in a traditional classroom was not a good fit, seeing that he was not codable, we had had him tested, so there were no extra services that were really available, meeting with teachers many, many times with him and having teachers that were really trying to help him. But our conclusion was the traditional classroom didn't meet his needs. He was starting to smoke dope regularly, which we began to see as self-medicating to keep himself in a system that didn't really work for him. So finally we just said, all right, go for it. What's your plan if you're going to quit school? And he ended up working. We told him that any plan that we felt good about, we would support 50-50 with him financially. And he decided to work till he had enough money to go to New Zealand. He left the country for 3 months with a backpack and a sleeping bag and a tent, and came back a changed person because he had regained his confidence in himself as a human being, which he had lost in the traditional classroom. So anyway, when the age was going to raise to 18, I said, oh my God, what would we have done if they had wanted to keep him in school until he was 18 years old? He would have gone down the drain. So anyway, that's our experience. Our son was lucky because he had two parents and some financial resources behind him. But unless you have questions, I'll hang up and listen to the conversation.
What a story. Thank you so much for calling in, Shelley. And Paul Leather, you do hear those stories every so often about, you know, the person who just doesn't quite fit in school, and they wind up being the dropout, and then they turn in, you know, the people always say that about Steve Jobs, the co-founder of Apple. Well, Steve Jobs dropped out of school, and he wasn't in the typical education type, and he turned out just fine. Do we have wiggle room in the current system, or does this reinforce that there needs to be a wider array of services for people who don't see traditional school as a fit?
I think Shelley makes a very good point, and this actually was one of the big points of conversation with the legislation around compulsory education the first time around it came forward. And the research internationally and nationally is very strong that if you just raise the compulsory age without addressing the needs of students in a more individualized way, particularly those students who are at risk, you're not going to see much of a bump, and you could have some of the experiences that Shelley was concerned about. So actually, the New Hampshire statute is quite clear that it creates an opportunity for students to have a personalized learning plan that they would work with their educators, and they could do something very much like Shelley described with her son. That was fairly dramatic, but one of the things that we put in place at that time was extended learning. So students could, in fact, build on their strengths and their interests and thus gain their zest, if you will, in education.
I think a number of good examples of those extended learning opportunities exist in the broadest sense. We mentioned earlier the Virtual Learning Academy. There is an opportunity in a major group of course takers, our middle school students, who take that to accelerate their learning. Also, we have great cooperation from our career tech centers who facilitate the kind of work-study experiences for students, which often find a way of reconnecting students to their education because they see actual hands-on opportunities and the result of that new learning. So I think there are much progress has been made in the last 4 or 5 years on that subject.
Rob? I think the key in Shelley's story is that her son took charge of his education. You don't have to leave school to take charge of your education. And I think that that's the challenge in front of us. How do we help our high schools in particular to reengage their students, to help them take charge of their education? There are never before have the forces in education been so aligned in their favor. The programs in the department, the teacher unions are solidly behind change and in ways that they haven't been before. The colleges and teacher prep institutions are focusing on this. But we need to get this down at the high school level in particular and help all of kids look around and say, this is my chance. Let me go and grab it.
Let's hear from one more caller. Rebecca is calling from Stratford. Hi, Rebecca. You're on the Exchange.
Hi. Good morning. I had two comments. One was I'm an educator. I teach middle school. And one of the things that is so important is parental involvement. If you have parents that are not engaged and don't see the value in education, that attitude often plays out, you know, in children. You know, so that is important. And the other thing that I see is, you know, in keeping kids motivated until high school, in middle school, you know, sometimes with regular education students, sometimes with students that have IEPs, kids by 6th or 7th, 8th grade have realized that they can stop doing their work and they're not going to be held back. You know, we've had a big change in attitudes about retaining students and that it's damaging to their self-esteem. But it's heartbreaking when a 7th or 8th grader looks you in the eye and says, I don't have to turn in any more work. I'm going to be moved ahead. And there's nothing you can do about it. You can't make me do my work. I'm not going to. I don't care.
In a way, they figured out what Rob has called the game of school.
Yeah,
you want to weigh in on that for a second, Rob?
Well, it affects students at every level. The student who is thinking, well, I don't have to work very hard because I know what I have to do to get the B, the student. So, I mean, it is heartbreaking whenever we see children at whatever age saying, this is not about me. I can just sit here and let the system move us ahead. And so the engagement of students in their own learning, making them share responsibility for their, you know, boredom in school, which is the which we haven't talked about, which is a huge contributor to dropout. Boredom is not the teacher's fault. Boredom is something that teachers and students need to attack together.
Paul.
I know that we're reaching the end of our time, and I just want to give a shout out to the fact that 44 of our schools, of our high schools in New Hampshire, had below 1% dropouts this last year, the year that former Governor Lynch set as the zero dropout year, and fully 12 of our high schools reached zero dropouts. I just want to acknowledge the incredible hard work that the leaders and the educators, the students, parents, and the communities in those communities did to create this.
Well, that's a great bridge to what is my last question, and I'll ask each of you briefly. We've come a long way, clearly, since 2007. We still have, say, 1%, and obviously it's not spread evenly across the state. But what do we do if the goal is still to get to zero dropouts? How do we get there? What do we still need to do to get there? And I'll start with you, Mark Joyce.
Building on Paul's observation, I think it's very important for us to acknowledge the hard work it takes to accomplish this goal, not only by school leaders setting that goal, but by educators every day in the classroom. As Rebecca pointed out, it's an important role for parents, but the community as well. I think our next phase is to shift our thinking away from labeling a school and trying to understand the needs of individual children. We have children in this state who have very significant needs. Are we doing all we can as a state to help them? And I speak here of children who move here from another country. Do we have sufficient resource to help them acclimate? I'm here speaking also of children who might be subject to significant drug abuse. We have a woeful, inadequate resource base in this state to help those students. And so they are disengaged, they're doing themselves harm and their community, but it's bigger than any school.
And let me just turn to each of our other guests as we are running out of time. Briefly, Paul Leather, what do we need to do to get to zero on dropouts?
Well, I think we have to redouble our leadership and interest. I think we have to address what Mark is talking about, but we all have to do it together. I think the resources are there. If we all do it together, we make this a critical expectation within our society.
And very briefly, Rob, for you.
And we need to look at the difference between the 86% who finish but don't get the 14% who don't actually get their degree, and look beyond that to those who start college and don't finish.
A big thank you to each of you. Paul Leather is Deputy Commissioner of the New Hampshire Department of Education. Mark Joyce, Executive Director of the New Hampshire School Administrators Association. Rob Fried, Executive Director of the Upper Valley Educators Institute. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Mike Danielli. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteers, Priscilla Malcolm and Alan Cohen. Our intern is Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Key Shields. I'm Brady Carlson, in for Laura Kanoy.